Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Jeremiah Castle, an assistant professor of political science and public administration at Central Michigan University, having been freshly minted as a PhD from Notre Dame in August of 2015. Professor Castle specializes in the study of public opinion, voting behavior, experimental survey methods, and the influence of religion and media on voting behavior and political attitudes. He has published a handful of articles to date in venues such as the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion, Social Science Quarterly, and Politics and Religion. He recently finished a study with Jeffrey Lehman, David Campbell, and John Green on how the perceived religiosity of a political candidate affects the level of support for that candidate, and that will be the topic of our discussion today. And don't forget, folks, we have a presence on Facebook and Twitter, wherein we inform our listeners of upcoming episodes and other special goodies, so please link up with us over there. And speaking of future episodes, be sure to tune in next week for our annual Independence Day episode, this year featuring Professor Thomas Kidd talking about the faith of Benjamin Franklin, an electrifying discussion filled with some interesting surprises. But today we talk religion and politics with Professor Castle. Jeremy, thanks for joining us on Research on Religion.
It's my pleasure.
We always like to start off with a little bit of background on our guests, and given that you roughly fall into the category of the millennial generation, and we all know that millennials are abandoning the pews on Sunday and binging on Netflix, how did you end up in your professional career studying religion and politics? That's supposed to be a no-growth area.
Well, I grew up in central Indiana, and religion and politics certainly does not seem to be a no-growth area in central Indiana. So as I was growing up, my parents didn't attend church, but they were historically probably somewhere in the Baptist family of religions. And growing up, I always noticed, as early as probably middle school, political divides among my friends. And it seemed like religion had a lot to do with those divides. My friends who were involved in Fellowship of Christian Athletes and who went to the same churches all seemed to be of the conservative political affiliation, and my set of friends who I knew weren't involved in church all seemed to be of the liberal political affiliation. So it seemed to me that I saw that very early on. And the area that I grew up in central Indiana, is pretty dominated by either the Baptist strain of religion or a kind of non-denominational Protestant Christianity with an evangelical flavor. And when I went off to college, I went to Hanover College, which is a liberal arts college in southern Indiana that was founded by the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, which is a mainline Protestant denomination. And what I found there was really surprising to me, too. I had always assumed that religion would be, that religious people were affiliated with the Republican Party, and I started going to a few PCUSA services while I was at Hanover, and started to learn that their church had a very liberal affiliation. And as a kid from central Indiana who didn't have that much experience with religion because my parents didn't go to service, it was really surprising finding this whole new world of differences for me. And I guess that inspired me to, in college, start writing term papers, looking at the effect of religion on people turning out for social movements. And gradually, I assembled a few of those papers and thought, you know, what better thing to do with my life than spend 6 years at Notre Dame studying it and really coming to understand it in a pretty deep fashion. So that's kind of how my interest grew.
So you went to Notre Dame. Your parents must have been shining proud of you because you grew up in Indiana, and Notre Dame is the shining citadel on the hill, if there is a hill in Indiana, and that must be pretty cool.
Certainly. And, you know, if nothing else, all my friends who loved football were begging me for tickets from the moment that I signed up.
Yeah, yeah. But they're not just known for football. They actually have a very good political science department, a very large political science department, where you have a lot of people who specialize in a number of fields, but many of them touch upon religion there. So how did your graduate studies develop? Did you go in with an idea of saying, hey, I'm going to study religion and political behavior, or were you like the rest of us graduate students just kind of fishing around for a topic for a while?
I knew very much that I was interested in studying religion and American politics, and as I was narrowing down my graduate school choices between a couple of offers, that was one of the things that I was paying very close attention to, and I really couldn't turn down the opportunity to work with David Campbell, who I know has been a guest of your show on the past, as well as Jeff Lehman, and the thought of the two of them together being on a dissertation committee for a dissertation on religion and politics, I just couldn't pass it up.
Yeah, no, David is a fantastic guy. We haven't had Jeff on yet, but David has done some really, really class work, and you have an extremely good dissertation committee. So how did that all go? How did you kind of get streamlined into your main area of dissertation study?
If I'm being perfectly honest, it was a tough road. I struggled mightily to find a dissertation topic, and Dave and Jeff, I'm sure, will not in agreement on that one. You know, initially, I was pursuing a couple different angles on evangelicalism, and I think it was Dave who finally said, you know, I've seen a lot in the media about young evangelicals. Why don't you think about that for a while? And it turned out to be a huge blessing because once I had that direction, the story of the dissertation kind of wrote itself when I got into the data and started looking at young evangelicals.
Okay, and what was the topic of your dissertation? I mean, we're here to talk about your recent JSSR article, but just give us a brief flavor for what you were doing in that dissertation.
Sure. So starting around 2006 and 2008, there was a lot of speculation, both in the media and perhaps among academics as well, that young evangelicals might be becoming more liberal. And some people thought that might be because of forces outside of evangelicalism, like secularism, starting to affect young evangelicals. And other people thought it might be because of forces within evangelicalism itself, like the retirement of big figures from the religious right, like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and replacing them with a more moderate set of kind of figurehead leaders like Rick Warren and Joel Osteen. And so the point of the dissertation was just to start out asking, are young evangelicals becoming more liberal? And if so, is it driven by forces outside of evangelicalism, or is it driven by changes within evangelicalism? And to answer that question, then, I put together a theory of public opinion among young evangelicals that really stresses that the evangelical subculture is most likely to affect public opinion on issues that have been historically important for evangelicalism over time. So that's going to be things like abortion, gay marriage, a general conservative political affiliation. And then the evangelical subculture is going to have the strongest impact among those who are the most immersed in the subculture. And what I end up finding is, in terms of their partisanship and their ideology and their opinions on abortion, young evangelicals are more or less as conservative as ever. On some other issues like gay marriage and immigration, they appear to be changing, but that change seems to be concentrated among the least frequently attending evangelicals, those who are furthest from the influence of the subculture. So that's the kind of 2-minute version of the dissertation.
very well summarized for us, and I can see how this is going to bleed into some of the work that you're doing here with your colleagues that you've published recently. And you recently published an article in the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion, headed by Laura Olson, who was also a guest on the show, so shout out to Laura. Your article is entitled, Survey Experiments on Candidate Religiosity, Political Attitudes, and Vote Choice, with your colleagues Jeff Lehman, David Campbell, and John Green. What motivated that study? That seems a little bit different than your dissertation work.
Sure, although I think you're going to see some common elements, too. But the general story that comes out in a lot of the research on religion in American politics is religion is a multidimensional concept. So sometimes religion researchers talk about the three B's, believing, behaving, and belonging, and how when somebody says, I'm religious, they probably mean some mix of those three factors. And traditionally in American politics, it's been the belonging to a religious tradition that has divided the parties. So for much of American history, the parties were divided between a sort of mainline Protestant Republican Party and a Democratic Party that was Southern white evangelicals and Catholics and other religious minorities. And that really started changing in the 1960s and 70s, and that divide became more so about religious commitment or religious behaving and believing. So now the parties are divided where we have culturally traditional Catholics and Protestants in the same party, the Republican Party, against cultural modernists from all different types of religion in the Democratic Party. And when we started thinking about the literature on how religion affects candidate preference, we realized that most of the literature had focused on that religious tradition aspect. So thinking about, for example, what effect John Kennedy's Catholicism had on support for him in the 1960 presidential election. And we hadn't seen very many studies looking at how a candidate's comparative level of religiosity, how committed they were to their religious tradition, might impact how voters perceived those candidates. So that was really the big motivating factor behind the study.
Now, you're talking about voting behavior, and that is a huge topic in the subfield of American political science and as elsewhere as well as we get more and more democracies in the world. Religion plays a factor, but what else does? And also, to what extent is religion a salient factor in voting behavior, or is there just some kind of fringe thing that might tip a few people here or there but not really central? What things motivate voting behavior?
Sure. So that's a question that you could ask 1,000 scholars of American politics and get 1,000 different variations on an answer. But the way that I would summarize the research is the number one thing that predicts how somebody's going to vote when the election rolls around is their party identification, which of the two parties they feel that they're a member of. If I know somebody's party identification, I can predict how they're going to vote in the election at probably around a 90% accuracy just with that one single variable. So the interesting thing, though, when you ask how does religion affect voting behavior, is to think about first how does religion influence party identification. Because the scholarship says that party identification is a social identity in and of itself, but how does that identity form? And there are a couple different schools of thought, but all of them start with an individual's social identity, things like their race and ethnicity, their gender, their religion, their sexual preference, maybe their income level. How do those factors all influence the development of a person's social identity? So one pretty common school of thought says that those are the starting blocks. And from there, people choose a party by comparing their own social identity to the social identity of elites within the party. So an evangelical Christian in the 1980s might have looked at the two parties and said, well, Ronald Reagan is an evangelical Christian. A lot of Republicans at the congressional level are evangelical Christians. And a couple pretty prominent evangelical elites like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson are evangelical Christians. So I guess the Republican Party is the natural home of evangelicals, right? That's the way that model kind of works, of how people move from a social identity to a party identity.
So that voting on identity is actually pretty interesting. What you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is that most people don't pay that much attention to politics. We have other things that we have to do, get our kids to school, walk the dog, and go to work and all that kind of stuff. And we see these politicians out there. We don't know what they're doing, but we look at who we are and compare it to what they are. And if they're pretty close and similar, we say, well, they probably have the same political views as I do, if they have the same identity, same gender, same race, same religion. Is that what we're saying here?
That's exactly right. So in the lingo of the discipline, sometimes we call that a heuristic or a logical shortcut. A lot of voters don't spend every waking hour making flowcharts and detailed lists of the pros and cons of every candidate. A lot of voters react on the basis of knowing a few essential statistics about a candidate, like what is their party, are they affiliated maybe with the Tea Party or a group within a party, and then knowing that candidate's religion and maybe a couple key policy positions if we're lucky. And that's the basis on which most voters, turns out, make their decisions.
Yeah, and that's fairly understandable. I know a lot of people say, well, you should really investigate the issues, and I'm a political scientist, but I can't understand all these issues. I've got too much other stuff going on that it's often hard to do that. So I do rely upon a number of these different heuristics to pick party and to pick candidates and things like that. In terms of the list of variables that you've already tossed out, race, gender, ethnicity, sexual identity, and religion, as well as education, income, what variables tend to be the most salient in people picking their party identification and sticking with it?
So one thing that really tends to affect how people pick their party and stick with it is their level of political sophistication. And closely related to that, their ideology. So if somebody identifies as a conservative, they are more likely to sort of stick with the Republican Party over time. If somebody identifies as a conservative and is also highly educated on politics, you can take it as pretty much a sure thing that they're going to stick with conservatism for a good part of their life.
And where does religion play in this? Is that a major factor in terms of deciding this or not?
Certainly religion is a major factor, and I would say that the way that religion works is probably more in that it influences the development of conservatism and that ideology that then plays into that lifetime of political affiliation.
Okay, so we have religion here as one of the heuristics that people use for picking candidates, picking parties, and for the most part, people kind of get to their party and they stick with their party, but there can be changes, and that those changes can be of immense importance, swinging an election one way or the other. So you go out here and test this in your JSSR article to find out whether or not a candidate identifying in some particular religious manner or secular manner has an impact on whether people are going to be attracted more to them or be dissuaded from supporting them. So go ahead and give us some of the ideas, or I should say some of the methodological ideas that you brought to bear on creating this study. How are you going to test that thing?
Sure. So testing stuff, testing ideas like this with candidates turns out to be really tricky because the problem that we run into, I could easily give people examples of two Republican candidates, one who is very religious and one who is not, in real life, or the same for Democrats. So for Democrats, I might say, tell me how you feel about Barack Obama, a Democratic candidate who, by most accounts that I read, is a pretty religious Democrat. And compare him, on the other hand, to somebody like Howard Dean, who, by most accounts that I read, is a more secular Democrat. And tell me which one of those candidates you like better. The problem is there are a lot of other things about those candidates that might influence the way we feel about them. And I want to make sure that the only thing, our team wanted to make sure that the only thing that we were measuring was a difference between candidates on religion. And so what we did is we used a survey experiment. And the benefit of a survey experiment is that it allows us to control the difference between the two candidates so that the only difference that respondents are exposed to is in the candidate's level of religiosity or secularism.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about that experiment in a second, but you mentioned that you're working with a team, and I noted that you had four authors on this study. You were the lead author, and at the bottom of the first page of the article, it says, you know, corresponding article, please contact Jeremy Castle at University of Central or Central Michigan University. I got just a logistical question on this. I've never worked in a study that big or with that many people. How is it managing something like that? Did you have a specific division of labor? And how did you get to be the one who is the top dog that everybody have to send off their emails to?
So I got to be the top dog mostly by luck, actually. So it turns out Dave, Jeff, and John Green ran this experiment in 2009, and I started grad school at Notre Dame in 2010. And at the time, David Campbell was just finishing up American Grace, his big book with Robert Putnam, and he was on a book tour that fall. And Jeff Lehman, shortly after I got to Notre Dame, became director of graduate studies, which is an administrative position handling the ins and outs of the PhD program that takes up an awful lot of time. And so what that meant was they had this data that they had just collected, and they didn't have any time to analyze it. And so by virtue of luck, Dave and Jeff asked me to take this data and start working on it. And so I became lead author basically by being lucky enough to be a first and second year graduate student who had the time to do the analysis on the data.
Hmm. So you start doing this. Now, this was a survey conducted in 2009. It's a survey experiment. What does that mean, survey experiment? That I know about surveys. I know about experiments. But putting these two things together, is that the hot topic now in political science? What?
It certainly is a hot topic for exactly the reasons that I outlined. As we're trying to understand how different differences in framing or how differences between candidates affect public opinion, we want to make sure that it's actually that difference in religion or religiosity between the candidates that's causing the difference in support. And survey experiments are a really convenient way to do that and be absolutely sure that the difference is due to religiosity or whatever variable we're testing. So how this works in practice is that we start out any good experiment with a control. And so our control in the paper was just a brief paragraph describing a candidate for a state legislative position. And the basic description just hits on this candidate is running for the state legislature. He is a local physician. He's 44 years old. He's married and has three children. He's a prominent member of the community and has long been active in local politics. When he was asked why he's entered the race, he said, I'm running for the state legislature because I want to see good jobs, a strong economy, quality schools, and efficient government. So there's not any cue, any mention of the candidate's religion there. And so in our experiment, one-ninth of the total number of people who were treated received that control treatment. And then the rest received a variation where we said either the candidate has no party, he's a member of the Republican Party, or he's a member of the Democratic Party. And then we either gave no cue about his religion, we mentioned that he was moderately religious, we mentioned that he was extremely religious, or we mentioned that he was very secular. And this way, we can be sure that the only difference between the candidates that the voters know about is his religion. And so then we can be sure that when we say that it's a candidate's level of religiosity that voters are reacting to, we can be sure that we're accurate.
So the original statement that you read was pretty generic. You know, do you support jobs and, you know, safer work environment? You know, everybody supports that kind of thing. Right. Did you do anything like have a picture of the candidate, or was this in a news article or some kind of simulated voting pamphlet or something?
In this case, it was not. Since 2009, when this has ran, it has become more common to include kind of additional details like a picture or whatnot. The key to doing a survey experiment and keeping it valid is making sure if you show a picture for the candidate that's the control, it has to be the same picture as the picture for the candidate that's the treatment to make the experiment valid.
Yeah, I was wondering if they had a picture of, like, David Campbell there and, you know, the blue blazer and red tie he supported. He acted as the candidate, but that'd be kind of interesting. Now, you mentioned as well when you did treatments, you identified them as a Democrat or Republican. That's pretty easy to do. But how do you identify somebody as being really religious? Do you just come out and say, this guy's really religious, or do you do something else?
Sure. So in the control, we said he's one of the most prominent citizens of his community, has long been active in local politics. In what we called the strongly religious treatment, we said he's one of the most prominent and deeply religious members of his church and has long been active in local politics. When he was asked why he entered the race, he said, as someone who has a personal relationship with God, I believe that we need people of faith in government. I'm running for state legislature because I want to see good jobs, a strong economy, quality schools, and efficient government.
Mm-hmm. So saying something to the extent of, I want to see more people of faith in government, that's a big, huge cue and a heuristic that people might do. He's a regular churchgoer that I could see in the pew on Sunday, so he's probably like me. That's what you're getting at then, right?
Right, and we wanted to use language that sounds like language that candidates actually use. And, you know, I think we can probably imagine some candidates who talk like this on the campaign trail. So I'm pretty happy with the way the treatments turned out in that way.
And who are the subjects, and how many of them did you have?
The respondents come from a company called YouGov Polymetrics, which specializes in creating online samples that are nationally representative. And so this particular experiment comes from an omnibus survey called the Cooperative Congressional Election Study, where researchers can essentially buy time on the survey to run their own experiments. So there were 3,000 respondents total split up between those nine categories.
Hmm. That's a pretty big sample size. Usually you don't get that many, but that's good. Okay. And do you know anything about the nature of these? Were they mostly men, mostly women, a good mix, a pretty representative mix of America, or what?
The research on YouGov Polymetrics' sample has generally concluded that they're pretty close to nationally representative. The only concern is that sometimes they can be a little bit more politically knowledgeable than the general population, but it's a pretty close approximation, and that's why they're becoming pretty widely used within the social sciences as a means to gather a pretty high-quality sample that's much cheaper than some other methods like phone interviews that you could use to put together that sample.
Okay. And are they taking this online? You're not bringing them in at Notre Dame or anything. They do this online?
No, this is an online survey.
Okay. All right. So they're doing this online. You're asking them some things. A ninth of them get this basic generic candidate that could be anybody. Some of them you identify by party. Some of them you identify by religion. And then there's some interaction effects here. What do you find?
So what we find is, just as we would expect, respondents who have higher levels of religious commitment tends to favor the strongly religious candidate, and respondents who have who are more secular tend to favor the secular candidate. That said, when we control for the religiosity of respondents, we still find that a candidate's level of religiosity conditions the impact of party identification or cultural issue attitudes. That is, for example, a Republican who is strongly religious gets a boost among strongly religious voters. But even once we account for that boost, the candidate also seems to get a boost among Republicans. And what that signals to us is respondents who are evaluating candidates tend to reward candidates who fit the kind of prevalent stereotype of the party. So strongly religious Republicans and secular Democrats tend to do better even once we account for the religiosity of voters. Because it's increasing the impact of their party ID and their social issue attitudes on how they evaluate that candidate.
So it tends to act as a catalyst in many respects.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, one of the things you said, that the religious identification, if the candidate is saying, I'm a person of faith and I want more people of faith in there, people of strong religious background who attend church a lot and have strong beliefs will probably gravitate to that person. But is there what I might call a repulsion effect too, that somebody who's very secular and hears the person saying, oh, I'm a strong person of faith, you go, whoa, I'm never going to vote for you, dude?
The interesting thing, as we look across our treatments, it's the case that even a strongly religious Democrat continues to do pretty well in terms of their likelihood of voter support. The one place where we see a level of repulsion is for the Republican candidate who was identified as secular. And there, even Republicans seem to evaluate that secular Republican candidate as essentially no better than a Democrat. So that's the big area where we see some of that backlash against a candidate's religious affiliation or religiosity.
Now, one of the interesting things that's come about in this partisan reshuffling over the past few decades is that Democrats have gone more secular and Republicans have gone in a more religious direction, or so the research is telling us. But that's not true of all Democrats. You mentioned in the article that a lot of African-American voters and also Latino voters are very religious and also connect with that kind of religiosity. So what did you find out with any kind of race or ethnicity factoring into this?
So we didn't really consider the impact of race or ethnicity. In general terms, I can say, though, the Democratic Party is a really interesting party to analyze the impact of religion on, because in a lot of ways it's a party coalition made up of small religious groups in one way or another. So you have black Protestants in the party who make up a decent portion of the coalition. But you also have a lot of Latinos in the Democratic Party who are very religious. But then there's side by side with a number of seculars. And seculars right now constitute about 20 to 25% of the American population, and obviously a much higher percentage of the Democratic Party's coalition. So one of the struggles for the Democratic Party is sort of coming to terms with a candidate whose religion appeals broadly to a lot of different constituencies within the party. And I think that explains some kind of really interesting anomalies that we see among Democrats on the campaign trail, where the diversity of religiosity among Democrats seems to vary a lot more than the diversity of religiosity among Republican candidates. And I think that's why, as Democrats right now are trying to figure out exactly how to appeal to these different parts of their constituency that are all very important to forming a winning coalition.
Now, talking about trying to figure out from the candidate side on what to do with all of this stuff, I'm always interested to what extent that candidates might actually be picking up our research and looking at and saying, hey, you know, this is what Castle and Campbell and all those other folks found. We better start, you know, changing our message based upon the graphs that they had on page 11 and 12 and things like that. Have you gotten any kind of indication that candidates are reacting to this research, either to yours specifically or to the subfield more generally, and trying to recondition some of their messages?
I have not, but campaigns are also very busy, and the last thing on their mind is emailing researchers to tell them what fans they are.
Yeah.
That said, very broadly, I think we can see some things going on in the 2016 election that seem roughly pretty consistent with the claims that we're making in the article. So, for example, if you take a look at the religiosity of Donald Trump, by most accounts of Donald Trump in 2010, 2014, before the election, most accounts would say he wasn't that religious of a guy. He seemed to be broadly affiliated with some strain of mainline Protestantism, but he, by most accounts, wasn't that religious. But on the campaign trail, he actually talked about having recently sort of renewed his faith and faith meaning much more to him. And he made a habit of making friends with evangelicals on the campaign trail. In particular, Jerry Falwell Jr., the son of the famous Jerry Falwell, who was an important figure in the religious right. Jerry Falwell Jr. and Donald Trump became pretty close allies, and Donald Trump regularly appeared at Liberty University, which is an important evangelical university that was founded by Jerry Falwell, to make speeches and appeal to the evangelical coalition. And so it seems as though Donald Trump, during the campaign, ratcheted up his level of religiosity. And that's exactly the type of behavior that we might expect from a candidate who realized that religiosity was an increasingly important factor in how voters evaluate candidates, and in particular, for a candidate who realized that in order to maximize support among Republicans, he would need to be able to speak the language of a highly religious evangelical.
Yeah, kind of interesting stuff here. The work that you did in this experiment, I think, was based on, was a congressional candidate or a state legislative candidate?
Yes, this was a state legislative candidate. Okay. And the reason we did that is actually just a pragmatic reason. We have this candidate, Rick Adams, who's a legislative candidate in another state. If we said, a candidate for president said, voters tend to know who those candidates are and are going to make inferences based on something other than religion, which is the thing, or religiosity, which is the thing that we want them to focus on. So it's just pragmatic that most voters aren't going to know their state legislative candidates, particularly in 2009, which was not an election year. So the treatment was more likely to isolate that effect of religiosity.
Yeah, it's a nice way of conducting the experiment and controlling for a lot of confounding factors that might come in. One of the things that interested me as I read your article, I kept thinking about, okay, how are other ways that we could test this? Is there any literature out there or any studies that out there that look at the concentration of, let's say, churches within a state legislative district, and then how likely a candidate is to start using the religious verbiage or the secular verbiage? I know here in downtown Seattle, they would probably not use a lot of religious words, but they would cue into a lot of secular things. But if you go to, you know, somewhere in the Bible Belt, religious words are going to probably pop up. Are there any studies along that line?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I haven't seen them if they're out there. But that seems like the type of thing that somebody would have done somewhere along the lines. And if not, it's an area that's ripe for study. I think there's probably methodological issues that lie within, in terms of, you know, the concentration of churches in an urban area like Detroit or Chicago is going to be pretty high, but that's not going to mean quite the same thing as the concentration of churches in an area of rural Indiana like where I'm from. So it would be interesting to see how it all shakes out and whether it works in spite of those methodological issues, or if you could solve those methodological issues.
Mm. One of the other questions I had, too, and this is kind of the pragmatic application of your research, is, you know, to what extent do these candidates actually choose the language that they're using as in a very strategic and intentional way, as compared to, well, no, they just kind of grew up in central Indiana and the God talk is all around. And so, you know, if you pluck somebody at random to run from office, they're probably going to be a churchy type person and they're going to be saying churchy type things. It seems like the stuff with Trump at the national level suggests that there's a little bit more strategery behind their choosing of the religious language. But do we have any sense for how this might play out in terms of causality?
No, we don't, and that turns out to be one of the hardest questions to answer, because methodologically it would probably mean going and interviewing legislative candidates and their campaigns, and even then you're not guaranteed an honest answer. Right, people respond strategically because they know they're on record, etc. That said, outside of the Donald Trump example that I gave earlier, I think there are a lot of examples that we can see of candidates modifying the way they talk about religion in order to try to generate some support for themselves. So another example of this might be comparing Mitt Romney's religious language in 2008, when he was very clear about his Mormon religion and gave a number of speeches on the campaign trail where he talked very specifically about his Mormon religion, compared to the way that his religion was handled in 2012 as the Republican nominee, when he tended to downplay any specific mentions of himself as a Mormon. And to the extent that he talked about his religion, he talked about it in terms of, you know, I was like at services with my family, in these very general terms that evangelicals and other religious traditions within the Republican Party, other than Mormons, wouldn't kind of be reminded of the fact that they didn't share a religious tradition with Mitt Romney.
Yeah. So here's an interesting question I just want to toss out to you. This is kind of the utopia scenario for a political science researcher. If I could give you an unlimited amount of money to do a study to disentangle all these different causality things, how would you kind of set that up? What would you want to do?
Oh my goodness. As a researcher who, you know, currently, you know, one of my biggest challenges is finding funding for studies. I just can't even imagine what I would do with unlimited funding. That said, one caveat that we have in the article that is really important is that all of this in our article is contained on the premise that these are Judeo-Christian candidates. So we can't answer the question in the article, what would happen if, for example, two otherwise identical Muslims were to run for Congress, but one of them used the language of Islam very obviously on the campaign trail and another didn't. How would that affect things? Mm-hmm. So, ultimately then, with unlimited funds, one thing that I would think about doing is trying to expand this to bring in religious tradition as well, to see how things would change if we had not just a sort of Judeo-Christian running, but a religious minorities like a Muslim running. Would this same basic dynamic work, or does that change things?
Yeah, just a caveat on my part, too. I don't have unlimited funding to give to you, so, but it's oftentimes something very fun to think about. I tell my graduate students, if you did have unlimited funding, where would you want to take that? Because oftentimes they might find creative ways of actually doing it in reality with not necessarily needing as much funds as they anticipated to begin with. So always a fun exercise to do.
Sure.
Want to talk about something else you've done, too, because as I was going through your biography, you do a lot of work on religion and politics. You've worked with Jeff Lehman and David Campbell and John Green, who are giants in the field of religion and politics. But you also kind of struck out on your own and done a few things that interest me, things on the effect that the content of movies have on political attitudes. I didn't get a chance to read that article, but tell me what's going on there.
Sure. So research in communication and sociology and political science very early on started studying the impact of the media on people's political attitudes or people's attitudes generally. And one way that that research has been summarized in literature reviews is with the term minimal effects. And what they mean is the researchers went into those studies expecting to find that media would have a massive influence on public opinion, and they really weren't able to find it. And this was back in the 1940s and 50s. And so for many years in political science and sociology and communications, this was taken as kind of the gospel, so to speak, in a religious pun, that the media didn't have massive effects on public opinion. Over time, political scientists and others started to challenge that. So, for example, political scientists found the influence that the media can influence public opinion by setting the agenda or by framing issues and kind of telling us what aspects of issues to pay attention to. But it's generally still been regarded that media has pretty small influences on people's actual direct attitudes. And that has always seemed to me really surprising. And I think that doesn't fit with a lot of what we assume in pop culture. So, for example, in pop culture, a few years ago, there was a controversy surrounding the Lego movie because President Business in the Lego movie happens to look a lot like Mitt Romney. And there was discussion amongst some Republican radio hosts that perhaps this was Hollywood trying to send a message to little kids that Mitt Romney is a bad guy. And so this is the kind of speculation in pop culture that we wanted to challenge. So my co-author, Todd Adkins, who is another graduate student at Notre Dame, Todd and I worked together to design another experiment. This time, we asked students at Notre Dame to watch one of three movies, and then we surveyed them right after the movie and 2 weeks after the movie on their political attitudes. And so they watched a movie called That Thing You Do that has no political messaging whatsoever in it. They watched a movie called As Good As It Gets, starring Jack Nicholson, that has a pretty subtle healthcare, pro-healthcare reform message. And then they watch the movie The Rainmaker, which has a very direct pro-healthcare reform message. And what we found was that both directly after watching the movie and 2 weeks after watching the movie, those who watched The Rainmaker were more liberal in their attitudes on health care. And so we infer from that then that movies can have a direct impact on people's political attitudes. And it's particularly surprising because the experiment was done in spring of 2011, right as health care reform was kind of reaching its zenith of importance. So if it can affect changes on a really salient issue like health care reform, imagine what it might be doing to other issues that aren't really in the national conversation yet.
Yeah, I just went to see Wonder Woman this past weekend, so I'm wondering how that affected my voting habits. I don't know. It was a great film, by the way. And what a cool study. You get to sit around and watch movies. And you did a pretest with the students, though, right?
Right.
Okay.
So they were actually tested 2 weeks before the movie, right after the movie, and 2 weeks after the movie.
Wow. And you found the effect was pretty big, especially the more blatant the message was. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. We'll have to point people out to that research. You'll be able to find a lot of links to Professor Castle's bio and his works there on our website, so please do check that out. In conclusion here, I want to ask a question I always love to ask my guests, and that's a reflection on the research that they've done and how it's changed their views of the world, if at all, and if you've ever discovered anything surprising throughout the course of your studies. So tell us about that. Has anything changed your mind over the past 10 years of doing this stuff, or is pretty much confirm everything?
Well, certainly I've been surprised in my research. So, for example, I talked a little bit about my dissertation studying young evangelicals. And when I set out to do the dissertation, I actually expected to find that young evangelicals would be massively different from older evangelicals, in part because of things that I experienced in southern Indiana, of seeing friends of mine who were evangelicals start getting interested in books like Shane Claiborne's The Irresistible Revolution, that is certainly a far cry from the type of religious writing that key figures in the religious right like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson would do. So I expected to find that young evangelicals were becoming much more liberal, and it turns out they aren't. So I'm wrong all the time in social science, and I always tell my students that's one of the great things about doing empirical research is you can test your own assumptions and see if you're right in the way you think about how the way the world works. So I'm wrong all the time. Beyond that, though, I honestly believe that academia is the coolest career that somebody can get involved in terms of every day I'm learning something new, and my job is basically to watch society and try to explain what's going on. And so one of the things that I suppose this isn't something that I've learned, but it's something that I think it's really cool to watch and think about, although also worrying, is polarization in American politics. And one of the themes that you see throughout a lot of my research on religion is the dividing of Americans into these two different coalitions. And it's something that a lot of Americans see kind of on the ground on a daily basis. But as a researcher, you know, I can see the differences between Republicans and Democrats and, you know, what kinds of candidates they like and what types of policies they like. And I say that's a really interesting thing, and something that I've learned is just how deep that division appears to be, although there are certainly researchers who would disagree with me and say that division, that divide isn't as deep as I think it is. But it's just been fascinating for me to sit and watch subsequent research reports come out talking about who's divided and why they're divided and what we're going to do about this divide.
Well, that is something that we will be watching, and as well as watching how the religious divide in America, if it continues to grow between seculars and the strongly religious, how that plays out in terms of politics. And we'll be definitely revisiting some of your work as you do it and continue doing your interesting work in this field. My guest today has been Jeremy Castle. Jeremy, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.